Good morning and welcome to IT1, Chapter 5, Part 2. That's where I'm getting the Part 2 from. And we have a lot of people on channel today, so welcome everybody, and hope you're enjoying the lecture, whether you're listening live or you have downloaded it from the QCAT server. Okay, well, what I thought we might do this morning is start off with a module quiz from Chapter 4. And I know there's been a lot of discussion about it, so we all should be able to get some of these answers good. Grace did put out a worksheet in addition to, well, there's actually no official Chapter 4 notes, so no official Chapter 4 worksheet, so Grace made one up about 2 weeks ago, which some of you have submitted, so that's great work, thank you. I'll just scroll up to the top of it. So has everyone got their chat windows open? It's looking like you have. Okay, now this is all about preventive maintenance and maintenance plans, and I'll start off. Right. Okay, question one out of module four. Which three common tasks are performed during preventive maintenance? Choose three. Check and secure loose cables.
Yes, no, this one?
We can yes, no, this. Yes, thank you. Check and secure loose cables. We have one answer and advances on two answers. Mm-hmm. Okay, do we update the RAM? Yep, no, exactly. Do we clean the mouse and the keyboard? Great, they're firing well today. Do we update drivers?
They probably want yes, but if they're not broken, don't fix them.
Well, I was reading this earlier this morning going through what I wanted to present, and yeah, the Cisco answer is yes, but I would agree with Kerry. Don't fix what I...
I would update them.
Well, only if they're broken.
Depending.
Yeah. Okay.
There's more than one occasion where things on Windows Update, where the Windows Update versions of the drivers have hosed my system beautifully.
Well, here's a good one.
Yeah,
for
but
all
if they're from
home.
The website, if they're from the actual manufacturer website, sometimes it is a good idea to update them.
I've had them hose my system too.
Right. Well, here's
She's
one for
very
you.
Hand here.
Yeah. Here's one that'll for you ham-fisted people then. Upgrade the reinstall the operating system. We've got one now.
Did you mean loud or hot, Chris?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And the last option for that, install additional peripherals. By this time, I've probably forgotten what the original question was. Question two, in which two situations is it recommended to ask the customer to sign a liability release form before attempting any work? The technician needs to share the responsibility with the customer. You can answer yes or no. The information on the computer is critical. It's actually no, according to this, and the reason is because the next answer is an interesting answer. The technician is unable to back up the customer's information. Yes or no? The information in the backup... Look, I probably would too. The information in the backup is confidential. Is the option D. Yes or no? And option E, the customer is unable to provide a backup. Yeah, exactly. So basically, if the customer can't provide a backup, or if you're unable as a technician to back up the customer's data, then you make them sign a liability form, because if something goes wrong, they'll be quick to blame you. Question three, what is the first step in the troubleshooting process? There's one answer to pick here, so I'll just read them all as normal. Gather data from the computer.
Yeah, we've all agreed that you don't agree with the answer to the question. Can we move on?
Yeah, it would be good. Thanks, Kerry. Just so to help the others along, I'll read it again because I've now lost focus. Question three. What is the first step in the troubleshooting process? Option A, gather data from the computer. B, gather the data from the customer. C, verify the obvious issues. D, evaluate the problem and implement the solution. E, close with the customer. Or F, try quick solutions. Any further answers? Those of you who got B are correct. It's gather data from the customer. It's the first thing you do in the troubleshooting process because you want to know what the customer was doing at the time a problem occurred and what may have happened since.
Just a note to say that ITE 4 revision 4.1 is soon to be released, and it may address some of the inadequacies in the current set of quizzes. However, we won't be moving to it until the accessibility of the curriculum is assured. So yes, we know there is errata in ITE 1 version 4, and we apologise for that. And yes, we do agree with you in principle that yes, that would be a situation in which you back up the data, but you're supposed to pick the two best answers as far as they're concerned. So there you have it.
Yes, I think the release date I was reading, I think it's February 2010.
I thought it was going to be earlier than that.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. Something else I was reading. Anyway, as Kerry says, we'll have to check the accessibility issue. Question 4. Which type of question allows the customer to completely describe the problem? A. Closed-ended. B. Open-ended. C. Specific. D. Technical. Oh, well done, folks. Question 5. What is the last step in the troubleshooting process? A. Gather data from the computer. B. Gather data from the customer. C. Evaluate the problem and implement the solution. D. Close with the customer. And E. Try quick solutions. Everybody who got D is correct. And of course, my answer from last year was send the invoice.
Absolutely.
And that, according to my notes, is it? There were only five questions in that little quiz. So there you go. We're over it.
Thanks for that, Elise. Sorry I couldn't be there to do that.
That's my pleasure. Not a problem, Grace. We sort of merged into Chapter 5 last week anyway after you finished the Chapter 4, so I was looking over the way we did things last year and thought it's good to have the previous modules quiz at the beginning. See how many people remember or forget things through the week. Okay, welcome back to Chapter 5, of course, where we did have a sort of a brief 40-minute chunk of it last week. And in that 40-minute chunk, we described the setting up of, we started to describe the setting up of an operating system. And I'll just start with a couple of questions. What are some of the, just as a bit of a warm-up, because I know a few of you weren't here, what are some of the most common operating systems that sort of come to mind when you think about operating systems and installing them?
Anyone?
XP?
That's one. More specific, what XP? What's the word that goes before
Windows.
XP?
XP Professional?
Yeah, we wanted Windows XP. But, yep.
I'm not answering that. Any other operating... Well, any other flavours of the micro... Any other flavours of Windows, like earlier versions?
There's Windows 95 through 2000.
Which includes 95, 98, Millennium, and 2000. Yep.
How about Windows Server?
I agree.
98 SE should be considered its own version. Well, there were a lot of changes.
And more features.
And more bugs. Well, less bugs, different bugs.
Less bugs, different bugs, yeah. So, and then we had the different flavours of Windows NT, Windows NT version 3.5 and version 4, sort of morphed into Windows 2000, and we sort of have Windows XP, all the different flavours, Home, Media Edition. We have Windows XP Professional, which I think most people tend to like running, and then into the Windows Vista. Go ahead, Kerry.
I was just about to say, no, a lot of people, especially if they're blind, don't like running Windows XP Professional because if you're buying JAWS, it's
Of course, it's a lot more expensive,
license.
Yeah. That's true. Then we've got the Windows Vista varieties, which come in more varieties than you can poke a stick at, which causes a lot of problems when it comes to remembering them all. And I'm not going to even go through them here because Windows Vista is soon to be obsoleted. Yeah, Vista and T6, exactly. Vista soon to be obsolete by Windows 7. Who knows? And I'm led to believe they probably don't offer as many varieties, and because it was really a marketing nightmare. It was marketing gone stupid, to be honest, with the amount of different flavours of Vista. So there's a number of different Microsoft...
XP, though.
Yeah, well, that's true, but...
It was a money thing. They were trying to make money,
really?
But they ended up losing money, I think. Wouldn't you say?
No, they didn't lose money. It was very successful because you had people selling Windows XP Starter Edition. You had Home Basic, Home Premium, all of the other versions. And you could actually go to the Anytime Upgrade link and pay Microsoft to change which version you were running. So I think as far as their marketing department worked, they went well with that.
Yes, it's yet to know them all if you're a salesman in Harvey Norman or something. Anyway, so there's plenty of Microsoft operating systems to choose from. There are other operating systems. Can we think about, obviously Kerry knows all these and Geraldine, but other people out there, can you give some thought to other operating systems?
Linux?
Yeah, good old Linux.
There's probably about 50 distributions of Linux, but as a class of operating systems, yeah, we could say Linux.
Yep. OS X, DOS, of course, that came sort of before and during parts of Windows. BSD. What about the good old Macintosh?
Yeah, it's got OS X written there.
Sorry, did have OS X, I beg your pardon. And OS X, and now we've got Leopard and Snow Leopard, and Snow Leopard being the newest of the Macintosh operating system.
No, OS X. ONX is the global name for all the operating systems.
The global name for the operating systems.
Snow Leopard, yeah. And Leopard and Snow Leopard is the code names for the various releases. So Snow Leopard is 10.6.
Yeah, that's right, 10.6 Snow Leopard. So there you go. When you install an operating system for your client, you need to determine which operating system will best suit their needs. So if you're building a computer for a client or upgrading or working on a computer, it's really good to obtain information from the client as to what sort of what they wish to do with their operating system. Further to that, you then have to address software compatibility issues. Be sure of what software they're running. Make sure it's the operating system and the software that you're about to install is compatible with the hardware that the client has.
That's true.
Yep. Well, just for the people out there and listening, then we're going to go and buy Chris a microphone. We talked about that last week, so he can join in. Basically, because the thing is, Chris, the chat doesn't come out on the audio for people who are listening, who are downloading this lecture off QCAT. So if you want to contribute, because some of your contributions are great, and we don't really want to have to repeat them. So you might be exploring what are the general office applications, business applications, if they're into graphics or multimedia, what sort of multimedia applications they're going to be using. You need to know the RAM capacity of the computer, the hard drive size of the computer that you're about to install onto, the processor speed, and the video card memory and speed, particularly if you're dealing with somebody who's using graphics. You can obtain a hardware compatibility list from Microsoft or from whichever software vendor you're installing. And it's always a wise idea if you're not sure on something. Microsoft has very good HCL for people who wish to upgrade and change operating systems. The notes here talk about briefly compatibility mode, which allows a...
Yeah, that's true. Although the reason it can't use more than 4 gig of RAM isn't a licensing issue, it's the fact that it's a 32-bit address space, which can only get at 4 gig of RAM. Not in the underlying kernel, it doesn't, and not unless you're running a 64-bit operating system.
So the people out there, Chris and Kerry are having a discussion on, what is it? The amount of RAM that Windows operating systems can address.
It can. The implementation of the kernel in the 32-bit version of Windows limits how effective the physical address extension can be, and it's also a limit on the paging model. But anyway, suffice it to say, everyone, if you've got a 32-bit version of Windows XP, you can only get at 3.6 gig of RAM, even if other better operating systems can get at more of it. So you are either pushed towards 64 or towards a newer version of the operating system. Which, sadly, is actually a concern for a lot of people, especially if you're doing 3D rendering and stuff and you need lots and lots of memory and lots of processor power.
What's the situation with Windows Vista on that, Kerry?
Same thing.
Yeah, Vista won't let you do more than 4 gig, I think, in 32-bit mode.
Right. How about 7? Assuming anyone knows at this early stage.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
Pretty much.
Yeah, I've seen that. Lots of machines are shipping with 4 gig of RAM, and the users can only get access to 3.6 gig of it. In fact, I remember when my brother put a gig of RAM in his machine a few years back, and he was running Windows 98. Windows 98 falls over if you put more than 768 meg of RAM into a machine. We had to hack one of his ini files to make the thing boot up.
The notes here just speak about compatibility mode too. I'm not sure why it brings that up at this point, but I think that just allows you to run an operating system so that applications that require an earlier version of an operating system actually believe they're running in that version.
Very important if you're running Vista and a whole lot of your old XP apps break in strange and bizarre and unusual ways, I think. Same goes for older apps, of course. Screensavers are affected, ironically enough, in a lot of instances as well. So, and they are things that people would want to run.
Oh, okay. Yep, fair enough.
And they do have some crazy ones out there.
Well, no, games used to be a problem in that crossover period between DOS and Windows, you know, in the mid to late 90s, where I had to help a whole heap of these people. I hated doing it too, where they would have their DOS games, and they would expect them to run under Windows 95, I think it was at the time. Maybe some 98s, 95 I think it was, and they had their own way of running in graphics mode and wouldn't really like running in a DOS box terribly well, some of them, so it was just a pain in the neck. Okay, now we're up to, we sort of touched on this last week, so we'll just go over it again in a little bit more detail. First thing, what's the first thing, once we've decided to install our operating system, we have our blank hard drive, we're ready to go, we've got the disk sitting there, and the first thing that needs to happen to a hard drive before we put an operating system onto it, guys?
Partition.
Well done. Yep, we've got to partition the hard drive. Now, most operating systems will have a utility in there to do that. Windows XP certainly does. Now, once
just curious. Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
just
no, curious. Go ahead.
In the event that there is no partition utility.
There is.
How does one deal with that?
There always is a partition utility, and in fact it goes back as far as DOS. You've had FDisk with DOS, and every operating system that's shipped out does have its partition utilities that comes with it. So you will always have the utilities for partitioning a hard disk that come with an operating system, unless, of course, the dog ate your install media and then you're in bigger trouble than we can probably help you out with.
Well, then you don't have the operating system either, so...
That's right. Now, of course, you can, if you have already partitioned your drive using a, you know...
yeah, I'd agree.
Yes, all the GRML people, thank you, Chris.
And Vinix 2.0, thank you. It's got partitioning, resizing and everything in it. Have you played with Vinix 2 yet, Elise? I'd assume not. I haven't.
No, I haven't. I've hardly even played with GRML, to be honest, but it's here.
Okay, well, fair enough.
Yeah, what the discussion is for people listening later is basically bootable operating systems that you can stick into your CD drive, rather like the old days when we used to stick a DOS boot disk in the A drive to boot a system up. And you can, yes, partition up a hard drive before you come at it with your Windows XP disk. So, yes, sort of to answer your question, Mark, if your drive is already partitioned, by means of you've got it out of another computer and, you know, the partitions are not formatted or they're blank or something, you can sort of bypass the partitioning step if you're installing. So Windows XP will support two file systems, because after you've partitioned it, you set up a primary partition, and Windows only really likes to have one primary partition on the hard drive, and you can extend that by having other partitions in the extended area of the hard drive, extended partitions. There are actually two file systems that Windows will support. Folks, can anyone tell me what they are?
NTFS and FAT32.
Well done, Leon.
Not as an install target. You can't install to an ISO 9660 file system, but it does support it in read. She's talking about install file systems that you can pick at install time when you're formatting your partitions. But yes, it does natively support ISO 9660 for read, but not for write.
That's right. FAT32 is generally offered when the hard drive is smaller than 2GB, and that's because it can only support up to 2.
No, you mean FAT16 is offered if it's smaller
than... FAT16 is offered on 2GB, yeah, sorry. And then FAT32 will support up to 2 terabytes.
Ah, I didn't realise there was a 2TB limit on FAT32. That's interesting to know. It's actually relevant these days, too.
Yeah, it is too, because we've now got these bigger hard drives. Well, that's what it says here in the notes. Generally, most people select NTFS, but if you are installing onto a FAT partition, you do have the option to convert that later on using the convert utility.
Just an interesting point here. If you're installing to a device that uses a solid-state hard disk, you're actually recommended to install to a FAT file system because it's less read and write wear and tear on the drive.
The user must, after deciding on which operating system to...
Good. Okay, let's at least get on with the lecture.
After you've decided which file system you're installing, it will take you through the format of that file system, so you have a nice clean slate on which to install. A little while further down the track, you'll be provided with questions that ask you input language, name of the person, name of your company, product key, administrative password, etc., and time zone settings. Now, we briefly touched on this last week. You'll be asked for that. Now, Grace has been speaking about the SIF files. For blind people, this is often a bit difficult because there's no talkies in the, particularly in the text part of the installation of Windows. And a lot of blind people are quite fond of the self-installs or unattended installs, where we'll probably talk about that probably more or less in lecture 12 or lecture 11, where you can actually put all of these settings into a SIF file. It runs the SIF file, including your product key, and basically walk away, come back, and you're up at a desktop.
I have those files, the templates and stuff that can go up on the server, but they are probably best covered in module 12, and I'll be putting those up probably after lecture today, so that people can get samples, but you can also find a podcast on the whole process and sample files on Blind Cool Tech if you have the time, inclination and patience to look.
Yep, and also you've got a very good lab that walks you through this. I think it's actually chapter 11, but somewhere around there, and actually walks you through this because there's actually a set of deployment tools on the Windows XP CD that you can anyone can use if they know how to, and the lab tells you how to do it, where you can create your own SIF file and put in at least some of the parameters, or all of the parameters. I actually did the lab myself last year when I was building a computer for my auntie, so it does work.
The Vista ones and the Windows 7 ones are fairly complex, and the deployment kit is quite large, so that is something to be aware of.
One of the things that will happen during the installation process of Windows XP is it will create you an administrative account. Will probably.
Yeah. Okay. Let's stay focused on the lecture. We can deal with SIFs in chapter 12.
You can run a Thursday chat on if you like, Chris.
I'd probably go.
Okay. The administrator account is created by default, and we'll ask you for the administrator password. You should really be creating user accounts, and you're often asked to do this later on during the process, usually at the out-of-box experience, I think. So basically, the administrator account is really an account you don't really want to log on to, but certainly keep a note of the password for it, because if all else fails and you need to fix a crippled or damaged Windows install later and down the track, to be able to log into the administrator account and run things like the recovery console, you can. At the end of the installation process, you'll be asked to register your copy of Windows XP and at the same time probably activate it. Now, you do have the option of leaving the activation until later on, as Kerry mentioned last week. If you believe that by activating it and installing additional hardware drivers for sound and graphics may change things, you've got 30 days for Windows to be activated in.
Just a point that in corporate versions of Windows, they don't bother with product activation because it is a real pain in the backside. Also, changes to your base hardware profile can invalidate your activation, and on a business installer or volume license version of Windows, you can have incredible trouble with product don't actually have to activate, which is good because it saves you a lot of trouble.
Well, it's just so time-consuming. And some technicians use the SysPrep utility as well if they're installing Windows across a large complement of similar machines. The system preparation.
Yeah, you can actually. You can get up to 180 days without activating with the newer operating systems. I think there was actually an article on that in Windows Secrets, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was a few weeks ago.
So you've got to this point of having your Windows installed. Before I go into the boot process, do we have any questions? Comments? Now's your chance, Chris.
Because you're the one who has the most to say. You walked into that one.
He did.
Because you tend to have a higher base level of knowledge than a lot of the other people who are currently here doing ITE1. And I am interested in seeing the lecture conclude as early as possible so that I can get to my hot cup of chai. That said, I would not impede the lecture in any way, shape or form, so I limit my level of interjections except for this particularly long outburst.
Indeed.
I just have to scroll up in my notes. I'll go back to Geraldine's notes here easy.
Oh, it's okay. It just it can actually just disrupt the lecture flow a little bit. And when we've got these quiet lectures that we... I mean, your content is valuable, but once we actually get a lengthy interjection, we actually have to all stop and listen to the chat, rather than ignoring you, because that would be nasty. And we find that it sort of breaks the flow of the lecture up, unfortunately. But yeah, your input is valuable and worthwhile. It's just better to sort of slice it in if you can when we actually do the question times and stuff, because if we don't actually get through the base syllabus material, then we won't actually get through the course and people won't do as well with the exams. That said, if anybody has any suggestions or recommendations on methods in which we could change the lectures in any way because they feel that there could be improvements, you are of course welcome to send your constructive criticism to CaviInstructors@gots.net, and we will do our best to take that on board.
Now, we covered some of this next part in the building of a computer in Chapter 3. The notes do require us to go through a small section. Yep, thanks. The notes do tell us to go through the actual boot sequence, and I'm about to take you through that. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's actually that's in the test, the boot sequence, interestingly enough.
I think you're right, yeah. So here we go, boot sequence. Step one, turn on the computer, cold boot. The computer performs the POST. Can anyone tell me what the POST, P-O-S-T, stands for?
Power on, self-test.
There she goes again.
And go, Leon!
Yeah, any errors will be reported by a series of audible tones known as... Yeah, somebody got that right. There's a POST for each adapter card that has a BIOS. If there's an error loading an adapter with BIOS, what's this say here? XXX ROM error message displays. There you go, thanks, Jeremy.
It does. Assuming it's not the video BIOS at fault.
Yeah, exactly. If it's video BIOS, then you might not see much. Now we get down to the BIOS of the machine. The BIOS of the machine reads the master boot record of your hard drive, which is known as Leon. Not yet. Leon, do you know what the acronym is for master boot record? Yep, MBR, that's
right.
Yep, MBR, so there's another one. Yeah, so if you hear the term MBR, Leon, it means master boot record, and that's the first thing that BIOS reads when your computer starts to boot up. In the MBR, it contains the partition table and the partition loader code. The partition loader code controls the rest of the boot process. MBR, or the master boot record, takes over the boot process and starts a file called NTLoader, or it's actually known as NTLDR. NTR runs nettech.com. I'll spell it for
ndetect.com.
ndetect.com. Thank you. Which runs, which then refers to boot.ini. And loads NTOSKRNL, which is the NT kernel, and hal.dll. From that point forward, system then refers to the registry files. And the registry is a database of information pertaining to hardware, software, and users on that machine. The system then refers to the HK_set of controls in the registry. Okay, and each user actually has its own, each user on that computer that there's an account for has its own, has their own section of the registry. Then the NT kernel takes over, which is known as ntoskernl.exe. Then refers to winlogon.exe, and I'm used to dealing with winlogon.exe. It's a file I had basically broken by a virus last year. Then we go to lsass.exe, which is local security file. So that's basically it in a nutshell. And it is in the notes. It's probably going to be easy for you to read the notes because it is in the test.
They don't actually ask you to name the whole boot sequence, but they do ask you the correct order of the boot sequence steps, so you should at least take a read through and try and get the steps in order. Does it matter? Sadly, yes. When your computer doesn't boot, you need to be able to figure out why and at which portion of the boot sequence it's failing, and actually take the corrective measures, unless you're one of those install at the drop of a hat types, or the I have a separate hard drive with a copy of this stashed in my desk drawer types.
Yes, when I was troubleshooting a virus on Evon's computer last year, it was rather handy to know which particular file was the broken one, which we did find that out, and was up to the latest part of the boot sequence when it got to NTLDR. That the system just basically almost halted, and if it did get to a desktop, it was quite sluggish.
Don't know.
Yep.
Actually, this brings up an interesting point. Does anybody know if there's a possible way to make it beep when the machine is ready to be logged into, like it used to under Windows NT4? I don't think there is a way these days, but there used to be. It used to go beep when you were ready to log in.
Actually, yeah, I've seen mine do it, but it was after I broke a network login. So if you break a network login or make it... Yeah.
Yeah, would it do it?
Oh,
I don't
maybe
know
you do
it,
have to set it to the controller. Set it to the
switch off the Windows welcome screen, put it back to this classic method.
And set it to prompt for Control-Alt-Delete before logon.
Mm. So there you go. I haven't tried it.
I broke a network logon and it beeped every time for about a week until I figured out what I'd done wrong. So that's not probably the best way to do it, but that's how I got it to do.
Yeah, but that's an error beep, and that's a service fail to start, so we won't encourage our students to do that. I think we'll encourage them to turn on the thing that asks for you to press Control-Alt-Delete, because that way it will go beep that way.
Probably a better idea.
Okay, the next part of it talks about manipulating operating system files. And there's two programs that most of us commonly use. MSConfig is a popular one. It's an easy-to-use editor that will allow you to make changes in the registry, make changes to system.ini, which we don't really use these days, control.ini and those and the startup files. Most of us tend to go into the startup and services tabs of msconfig, and you can control what programs are actually allowed to run at startup. I find that very useful if you've installed utilities like TomTom GPS, etc., that will insist on running its application, even if you don't, you know, like 90% of the time you don't have your GPS plugged into your computer, but the utility is still there taking up system resources just in case you might happen to plug it in and it loads faster. I tend to switch those sort of things off and run them manually at the time I do have the TomTom plugged in.
That's one of the first things I do, is find the services that don't need to be started up on startup and get rid of them.
Absolutely.
I thought that if you do it with MS-config, though, it puts your machine in selective startup mode, which means if some technician comes in later and flicks it out of selective startup mode, all hell will break loose. So I tend to go in and hand-hack the registry, but then again, I've had a bit more experience.
No,
it does put it in selective startup mode. In Vista, I think it does.
Okay.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. It actually, when you actually customize which services are going to launch, it puts you into selective startup mode, I believe. And then you click the dialog that says, don't ever tell me again, and then you forget, and you don't realize it's still in selective startup mode.
Okay.
It doesn't really matter unless someone else is messing with your computer.
No, that's right. Regedit, of course, is the utility that Kerry talked about. Go in there and crack it out of the registry. Note, regedit 32 was used in Windows NT and Windows Server. And Windows Server 2003 will recognize both regedit 32 and regedit. Now, there are the advanced startup options when you start Windows XP, and the key to get into those as it's starting is press F8. Sometimes if you do have trouble seeing your screen, you might actually miss the opportunity and you've got the GUI launched before you've pressed F8, so it's something you have to know when to press, basically.
For blind people, place a radio near your computer and get used to the noises it makes, and you will be able to tell when to press keys, for example, F8, so an AM radio if you happen to have one lying around.
Or if you have a PC speaker, wait till after the beep and then you can probably all right to press it. That's what I did.
Actually, some BIOSes actually only beep once at post and don't actually beep before they start the operating system, and some don't beep at post and do it the other way. So know your BIOS.
One of the boot options is a gotcha, and the notes refer to the fact that you can, if you do get into the F8 screen, you are presented with a menu, and they are safe mode with network support, safe mode with graphics, and command prompt, etc. One of them is start the last known working version of Windows. Now, this is a gotcha, because what happens is if you've managed to start your computer and it's broken, and it runs a bad version of itself, it will corrupt that key in the registry, and you won't, the last known safe boot up of Windows will no longer work. Do you have anything to say on that point, Kerry?
Yeah, I've seen that. If you do actually manage to boot it up to a certain point and one of the services does launch, it does corrupt the last known good key. It can get you out of the trouble in some points, but it can also make a mess of your registry as well.
Now, with the Windows file name and directory structure, once it is up and running, the notes do refer to...
I agree.
Oh, I think
probably because nobody wants it.
Because the NDIS drivers actually have a 16-bit fallback mode and the sound drivers don't. Not fair. I wish we could have it too. But the sound drivers won't run in 16-bit.
How about that? It's important to know. Because I've often wondered too.
Interestingly enough, under Windows 98... Sorry, I was just about to say, under Windows 98, you used to actually be able to use hardware speech in safe mode. Unfortunately, that doesn't work under XP anymore.
Yeah, really shields you from the hardware, doesn't it?
If they would just make safe mode with USB support, we could use Braille displays. Now, that would be actually probably really good.
But if the USB drivers are what's crashing your computer, you luck out. That's why it's called safe mode.
Yes, it's really tricky for blind people to deal with safe mode, isn't it?
It is difficult, but unfortunately in safe mode you are loading as fewer drivers as possible, and even the USB keyboards and mice run in BIOS legacy emulation mode, to actually run Braille displays which require serial support, you'd actually have to do an EHCI handoff, which would then mean you're in 32-bit mode and no longer in the realms of safe mode, sadly.
Are there any other questions or comments before we move on to talking about the actual directories and folders? Okay, obviously, with all operating systems, Windows XP is divided up into directories of folders and files. So, you're too used to saying directories. You can have folders within folders, they're known as subfolders, and you can have file names with up to 255 characters. There are a number of characters that are not permitted in a Windows file name, and they are \\*:\, question mark, end quote, and vertical bar is here on the list. I suspect that's in the test. And the reason you can't... Sorry, what's that?
You're right. It is in the test.
Yeah. It isn't, yeah, I seem to remember it. The reason, obviously, you can't have slash or backslash is because that is used to denote a directory if you're in the path, the address line. So you can't, there are a number of, just a few illegal characters that you can't put in a file name. Windows relies on the file. Yep, go ahead, Mark.
I was going to say, if you do, the computer will let you know it.
Yes, I've seen some quite nasty things happen with that sort of stuff going.
Yeah, but it still won't let you put the greater than symbols into file names, even if it is Unicode, because it just blocks them out and goes, ding, you cannot have one of the following characters, and it pops up a dialog box, which is very annoying, but somewhat informative.
With Windows, it relies very heavily on the file extension, which is the three or four characters that appear after the full stop. Unlike a lot of other operating systems that rely on the attributes of the file.
Yeah, that's right.
Unlike other operating systems that rely on the file attributes to determine whether it's an executable or not, Windows relies on the three-letter or four-letter file extension. Now, I'm going to just put that there for some people. What are some of the common file extensions that you're probably familiar with at the moment?
TXT?
Yep, used for?
Text documents?
Well done. Anything else? Doc and XLS are coming up on the chat. Used for? Docs are usually associated with Microsoft Word documents these days, and XLS is usually associated with Excel spreadsheets. We've got PPS coming. PPS coming up on the chat, which is your PowerPoint slideshows. Any others?
We've got .py, which is one that. Christopher's I'm infinitely familiar with, and probably .pyc as well, which are Python source and compiled Python binaries. We've got XE and COM, have we yet?
Not as yet. So XE and COM, which are executable files, which are files that run. DLLs, dynamic linked libraries, which are also small portions of larger programs that run when they're called, hence the reason why they're called dynamic linked libraries. Yep, go ahead, Kerry.
The first two characters of an XE file are always capital M, capital Z, which stands for a fellow by the name of Mark Sikorsky, who was responsible for the .exe file header back in the early 80s.
I think there's a question in the test that asks for the three types of executable files, and they're .com and .exe, and does anyone else know the other one?
Oh, is that a question you're putting out there?
Yes.
They want .bat.
I was going to say, what about .bat? SCRs are these, I never really saw them before Windows screensavers came along.
No, they're also, aren't they .scr also for the Windows scripting host?
Yes, it is. And for a myriad of viruses and worms that get sent around the internet.
Yeah, the right answer was bat. That is what they wanted. And I think it's on the final.
Yeah, I know you can.
It also goes on to discussing JPGs, and we might as well throw a few more in here. We don't have to go with what the notes just say. There's JPGs, MP3s, yep, anyway, let's throw it out there. Audio and picture files, guys. PNG, yep, good picture file format.
And we had AAC come in there, which is Apple's lossless format, or Apple's song format, I should say.
Yep. What about WAV, good old plain WAV?
Yeah, that was out there.
Was out there. So Windows will use those dot extensions to associate what program. It will look at the dot extension and go, oh, this is a WAV file. I better launch Windows Media Player or Winamp or whatever my preferred application is to play that file. Consequently, if it's a dot DOC file and Microsoft Word's installed, it will run Microsoft Word or WordPad if you don't have Microsoft Word installed, and etc. We then go on to attributes of files. And whilst Windows isn't relying on the attributes to know what to open the file in, it still requires them. Yes, Kerry?
I think so. It still requires what, sorry?
No, as somebody was micing up, I thought it might have been you. The notes just refer to the attributes.
No, I wasn't micing up for once.
Sure. Okay, the attributes are... Now, the reason we have attributes is we often want to mark a file as read-only or as I'll let Windows know that it's a system file, mark it the archive attribute, or we can even hide a file. So the four main attributes in Windows and DOS are, which is read-only, which makes the file read-only, which means we can't write to it or delete it. A, which means the archive attribute is set. and the file will be archived the next time the disk is backed up. S, the file is marked as a system file and a warning is given if there's an attempt to delete or modify the file. And H means that the file is hidden in the directory display. The file attributes may be displayed if you enter a DOS box and use the attrib command, as we used to in DOS.
Yes, it will.
I've not tried such a thing, just for the people out there in listener land. NTLDR, if marked with the archive attribute, will cause absolute hell, according to Chris. Why does that happen?
That's good to know.
With the file permissions, FAT32 and NTFS, of course, as we discussed earlier, can be used in Windows XP. NTFS can support larger and more secure files. Has more security features. Using the convert.x command, partitions can be converted from FAT32 to NTFS. The next part of the notes go on to the control panel. Now, do we have any questions up to this point? The next part of the notes refer to the Windows control panel, which a lot of people often forget about. And you can usually find that on the start menu. And once in the control panel, there are applets in there, for example, appearance and themes, network and internet connections, add or remove programs, which we'll discuss a bit later on, sound, speech and audio devices, performance and maintenance, printers and other hardware, user accounts, date, time and language and regional options, accessibility options important for us, and the Windows Security Center found in versions of XP after Service Pack 2. There are other tools you can use to manage and use for troubleshooting, like the Device Manager. A lot of technicians will use the Device Manager to view the IRQ and DMA settings of the devices, and as Grace was talking about last week, they look for devices that are either functioning or not functioning, and usually the ones that Windows is having difficulty with are denoted with a yellow exclamation mark, which JAWS doesn't read, but NVIDIA does. That's right. Now, I think there is a lab in Chapter 5 that asks you to add and remove programs using the Add Remove applet in the control panel. Somebody who's been through IT more recently might be able to confirm that.
Yeah, there is. You can just pick any program, basically, and do it. You don't have to do whatever program they say it is to do.
No.
Just pick one, or if you've done it, fill out the question.
That's right. You know,
make sure to pick
really
one you can get again. You could try and get like Winamp and install it and uninstall it and uninstall it again, or some free program like 7-Zip or something that is just, you know, easy to do and easy to get in small.
Don't do Winamp, easy you might not be able to play our lectures.
No, don't do Winamp.
If you uninstall it, you won't. You could.
But you can re-get it again, that was my point.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend doing Winamp because it can mess up your underlying codecs. I think 7-Zip would be a bit safer.
Some programs
just don't do like Microsoft Office.
Oh,
yep.
Yeah, quite right, Chris. There's actually the notes do say it removes the programs completely, but we all know that not to be quite right. How often have we gone through?
Sure. It does.
Cracked open a copy of the Windows registry or UC cleaner and stuff after you've uninstalled that program that you really tried to get rid of last Saturday afternoon, only to find bits of it still lying around.
Be aware, though, however, that if you get rid of too many bits of a program, too many bits of your system will also stop working, so careful when you're in the registry, and of course you do have backups.
Well, this is right, so you know, any hacking around in your system registry is done at your own volition, and we have nothing to do with it.
Can I ask a question here?
You may, go ahead.
Ask another one.
Why, when you do install a program and then you try to uninstall it after you don't use it or whatever, why do little bits and pieces of it just keep staying in your system?
It just simply doesn't get removed.
No, there's actually a better answer than that. Yeah, programs create files that uninstallers can't take care of, for example, temporary files. Also, some programs use that leave the user preferences behind in the registry. Also, there is no way of knowing which program installed what version 4.1.9.3.8 of Fugle7.dll, and if you uninstall a DLL without actually knowing who's actually registered it, you could actually stop other programs from working, hence the dire warning when you remove JAWS's shared components, because you might mess over... What's the other one? Oh, yeah, if you uninstall the JAWS shared components, you could kill Magic or Connect Out Loud or a whole lot of other Freedom products. And as Chris has just pointed out, there are bits of Quitter that can't be easily deleted, such as the configuration file and stuff, because it can't be sure whether they exist or not. So, yeah, there are actually technical reasons why you shouldn't uninstall every trace of a program. Imagine what would happen, for example, if you uninstalled the Visual Basic Runtime DLLs when you did an uninstall. How much of the system would fall apart in interesting ways?
I'd imagine that would not be a good day for the person doing that.
Although, technically speaking, if you generated the usernames, you could always stash that information in a configuration file so that the uninstaller could then read the configuration file and take the user databases with it. There you go, there's a feature suggestion, and I'm just stirring. Fair enough.
Occasionally you as a technician may be asked to upgrade an OS, and that means, in the example given here in the notes, to upgrade from, say, Windows 2000 to Windows XP. I've never actually done it, I've generally just gone and reformatted the hard drive, but I've started doing it, let's say. But I generally, usually by the time I want to perform that sort of an upgrade, I've hosed down the machine to the point where it's just going to probably create more problems, so you may as well just start with a fresh one, but it is.
Yeah, you can do it, and sometimes if you buy the upgrade version of an operating system, it's actually significantly cheaper than the full
version. To my dad's computer once.
Oh, look, it's no doubt easier to do, but I'm often worried about what might happen afterwards. Actually, I think I did upgrade some Windows 3.1 machines to Windows 95 back when.
The upgrades from XP and stuff are pretty seamless. You may get a few orphan files left around, but it does tend to work fairly well. Microsoft sort of tends to make sure that it does work fairly well because it's in their interest to sell upgrade versions of various operating systems.
No.
Probably not.
Changes kernels.
Windows 3.1. To Windows 7, yeah, it would be a challenge, wouldn't it?
You probably could do it, but I'd hate to see the level of orphan files. Yeah, you can upgrade from Windows 95 to Windows 98, and then you can go from 98 to XP, even though the kernel changes. You can do it.
Yeah, 98 will go to XP, won't it? You could drop in to pay a visit to Windows 2000 along the way if you wanted to.
Oh, wow. Okay, I didn't think that would actually work.
Yeah, like Kerry said, look, it is in Microsoft's best interest to make sure the upgrades are seamless and everything happens. So it's worth knowing about because some people may require you to do it. Now, again, it's like installing a fresh operating system. You need to check the minimum requirements of the new OS. Check the HCL again, the hardware compatibility list. Sorry, Leon, I should have asked you at that point. And back up all data that happens to be on the computer. Actually, it does. Yes, that's right. They do make backups of the older of the previous operating system, but it's always a wise move if you're going to perform any major surgery on a computer to update to back up the data, just in case something were to go wrong. Actually, it does
say
here in jail.
Back up the data anyway, because you just should in case your hard drive goes bad.
No, more specifically in case the upgrade procedure fails, which it does on unusual configurations. And in fact, if you read the upgrade notes, the first thing they do is tell you to make sure you have a complete backup.
It's a sensible thing to do. Well, what happens if you don't have an UPS and your power goes off halfway through?
Yeah, that'll really mess up your computer, but if you've got the backups, you'll at least have your data.
Well, I always maintain that the data is the most important thing on the computer. Operating systems and applications can be replaced.
I actually did a backup of my whole system one time when I first bought the thing. I made the mistake, though, of when I you know, you burn it onto a disk and you get like, I think I had like 8 or so disks, whatever, filled with, and it was all numbered, disk 1 through 8 or whatever. I made the mistake of getting all the disks mixed up at one time. I didn't number, I numbered the cases, but not the actual disks. Don't do that. Don't make that mistake. That makes trouble for you big time.
Yep, be always sure to that you know that your backup is going to be able, is accessible. A lot of people buy these backup programs and go, oh my god, I've got a backup program, and they go away and they backup God only knows what, probably even half the operating system, not just the data, and somebody like a technician comes along and go, what's this Fugle dang backup system you've got here? Well, I don't know how to use it, and do you know how to use it? You bought it. Can you get the data back out of it? And they'll go, they'll look at your ceiling and go, oh, no, never had to do that before. So you want to make sure whatever backup you decide to use, that the data that you've got backed up can be got at in the event of an emergency, because often when the emergency happens, stress levels are high and you don't have the time or the luxury of time to sit down and nut something out. You need that data back and you need it back now. Now back to Geraldine's notes here, it does actually say, and she's probably right because Geraldine's always right, that the upgrade procedure of Windows XP to Windows XP from 2000 is actually quicker than installing it from scratch. Oh, maybe I should try it into my virtual machine just for something to do one day.
No, that is actually correct. Because it can actually reuse a whole lot of files from the 2000 installation, and it sort of just updates the ones it needs to.
It might be just a good exercise just to try it one time. Oh, the notes bring us back into our beloved preventive maintenance plan and schedule, and because we've all gone and done ITE 1 Chapter 4, we all know about this bit.
We've all made one.
Yes, everyone's gone off and filled in Grace's little lab on Chapter 4, which is absolutely fantastic. So obviously, I'll just quickly go through it. Your upgrade and maintenance plan usually, you know, means upgrades, regular checking for updates and patches to your operating system. Updates to antivirus and other protection software. Cleaning the equipment. Checking your cables and connections. Hard drive error checking, backup and defragmentation. And document a repair log. You can schedule hard disk scans. You can run your defrag program. I actually defragged my laptop this morning at the wee small hours of the morning. And you can use the schedule task wizard to allow many of these updates to be run automatically. We then move into restore points. So restore points are quite an important thing now. They allow you, and have gotten even me out of serious trouble before, where you can take a snapshot of the current configuration, usually the registry, other important files used in the operating system. And that way, if something were to go wrong, or some program was to be installed that sort of broke things, and even in some cases, something like spyware got onto your computer, you clean it off with your spyware, you can roll the system back to a pre-known good state. It's always a good idea to make a restore point prior to installing any new software, so that if anything goes wrong, you can at least get back to a point prior to that installation. A lot of software will actually make its own restore point at the beginning of its installation.
Windows Update always does.
Yep, Windows Update's a good example of that.
Even Spybot Search and Destroy will make a system restore point if you set it to do that before it cleans up spyware, so that's also really nice.
Just in case, that was to clean up that wonderful little program called VNC that allows you to remote admin other people's computers or something, which is usually a common one that spyware programs go after. You can get more sophisticated and take images of your partition, but that's not in the notes. Troubleshooting operating systems at this point. Does anyone have any questions about restore points or maintenance schedules? In Chapter 4, we discuss the troubleshooting process and the way we ask open-ended questions to gather information. We have 6 points here, which is usually basically one, gather information from the data, from the customer. Information about the problem must be gathered so you can determine how to correct the issue. Use open-ended questions. Verify the obvious issues and from the customer's response. You should be able to ask yourself, are there any obvious issues to be verified? Three, try quick solutions first. I've seen technicians sit there and mess around for ages with a computer and only to find that one of the quicker solutions, like making sure the device is powered on or plugged in, would have actually fixed the problem. Gather information from the computer, and you can do this by examining system files, logs, the event log, the event viewer, to see what's been happening on that computer prior to the problem occurring, or as the problem occurred. Evaluate the problem and implement the solution. Implement your solution and test the results. Try the most likely solution first. Technicians can check the software publisher or check journals for other for the same problem. Option six is to close with the customer. Once the problem is solved, verify the problem. Complete any documentation, including sales orders, timing and logs, and receipts. Now, there's an option here for going over the benefits of being a nodes or a network operating system technician with the students. There's actually a good career path in that field if you choose to go down that track.
There's a lab for that as well.
Yep. There's some industry certifications in that, including Novell, NetWare. There's the CNA, of course. Linux Plus, MCSC, which are the Microsoft certifications. And as Grace said, there is a worksheet. I remember going through it, and I think you're asked to research some of those industry certifications that are available.
You also have the Net Plus certification through CompTIA. And that's the sibling to the A Plus certification, which this course is trying to prepare you for.
Now, we've briefly already discussed the differences between FAT32 and NTFS. So I won't bore us with that. Now, with the upgrade process, the maintenance process, there's many different ways we can actually tell Windows how to do upgrades. Can somebody out there give us pretty much the three settings that you would use with, say, automatic updates? And if you prefer to use one over the other, which one would you prefer to use and why?
There are actually four settings with the automatic updates. There's off, there's alert me, but let me choose to, he's got it.
Sorry, Grace, you go ahead because you'll be coming up on the audio.
Okay, we have off, we have alert me, but let me choose when to download and install them. There's download them for me, but let me choose when to install them. And then there is automatically download, install, don't even bother me with it, go.
And a note here, if you have it on anything but off, portions of Windows Update, including Windows Genuine Advantage, can be automatically downloaded onto your system.
Isn't that nice?
It actually warns you about that. It actually says, if you have it set to anything, portions of Windows Update may automatically be upgraded for you. Thanks, Bill.
Even if you've got it on Alert Me and I will decide when to install them.
Well, how about that?
Yep. So let's all go turn it off. It's interesting that, because you would expect it to simply tell you if... Yeah.
Well, I sort of can, but if you're not supposed to be using somebody's bandwidth or something, that could be quite nasty.
Well, exactly. And I think it's just nice to know if it says it's not going to download anything, it shouldn't be. I generally use the one on the start menu anyway. It takes you to the website in Internet Explorer, and you can sort of watch it all happen if you do that.
You don't get that anymore in Vista and later.
Why aren't I surprised?
Yeah, let's hide the experience from the user. Maybe they'll think it's not happening, except for when it goes terribly wrong and 6 balloons pop up. It probably would be for most people, but it is just, it's worth letting people know that it does actually pull stuff down, especially if you're on a thing where you're paying 20 cents a megabyte and you happen to have run over your quota. You don't want all of your house machines running up your bill even higher. So that's just something to be aware of, that Windows Update is updated automatically if the setting is set to anything other than off.
Here in Australia, they've got bandwidth caps, so say you get 40 gigs a month, and after that you get traffic shaped or you get charged extra for each megabyte you go over. It's not like America where it's an all-you-can-eat. We have not as much, though.
Depends where you are.
Yeah, it sounds like with the US, it depends on where you are, doesn't it? Who your provider is. So most people tend to go for the all-you-can-eat option, like Grace obviously did. How do you feel, Grace, being in Australia with our nice little download limits and stuff?
At least it's stable.
She just about cried when she went to download the Jaws beta at 93 megs and discovered it was going to take 45 minutes.
Oh, I bet you did.
Yeah, I reckon you guys are going to end up getting volume charged eventually if you're not careful. It happened to us, and it could happen to you. Be afraid.
Yeah, well, there you go. I don't know.
Wow, Comcast split theirs in half.
Since the dial-up days, haven't we, Kerry?
I remember it coming in 1993, actually, before the internet was into the public, and they were actually talking about volume charging the traffic that came in over the intercontinental links. AARNet was negotiating with it, doing that at the time, and there was a petition and a whole lot of us signed to say we didn't want volume charging, but apparently they claimed it was the only way to regulate the usage of the international links. Let's face it, if somebody can charge for a commodity, they will. No, but they want to make money.
The telcos here in Australia make outrageously high profits. They really do, and on simple little things too, like phone calls and stuff. So they're in the business to make money.
Also, in places like Europe and stuff. I mean, I think that the other thing is, though, if you let everybody just go, let's face it, most of the internet content that the US people probably want is in the US, so it's not as if we're dealing with transit links, whereas if you're in Australia, most of the content you are pulling a lot of the time is international content from other places.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, BitTorrent can bring any size bandwidth link to its knees if you've got enough people running torrents. So that's another thing they're a bit scared of. But I think they're just scared that the demand's going to outgrow the infrastructure. But we've wandered off topic, and for that I apologise.
That's all right. It's always good to have a bit of diversion here. I did actually skip the real mode and protected mode part of the lecture. I would certainly ask people to look at your notes, unless you briefly want to say something about that, Kerry, and then we can go into some questions and answers.
No, I'd suggest you read your notes because I don't want to mess it up. I know for a fact that protected mode puts the processor into a 32-bit flat addressing model, unless, of course, you do something nasty with the page tables, which we won't talk about. Real mode is where it runs in basically the DOS mode, and then there's a third mode called VM86 mode, which you can use to run virtual DOS boxes and operating systems inside a protected sandbox. And any more information than you want from that can either be looked up on Wikipedia or in your notes, because there are some technicalities I'm not full bottle on. We don't talk about Ring Zero here. But there is Ring Zero that gives you complete access to everything. But then it gets a bit more complex from that. So basically there are three modes, real, protected, and VM86. Real mode is theoretically what DOS runs in. Protected mode is what the 32-bit operating systems run in. And VM86 is what your DOS boxes and things run in. And that's about as clever as we get in this course.
Yes, it's only briefly mentioned. So, you know, back in the real mode days, if you had a program that would crash, it had access to the memory of the processor, it would bring the whole system to its knees. With protected mode, each program's a little bit more protected. However, it's up in the earlier part of the chapter, just before we install the operating system, for people who wish to read their notes. And I would encourage that all courses that you do read the class notes, preferably before the lecture. Because giving the lecture and allowing for time for input from students means we can only really give a sort of an overview of the notes.
And in fact, if you all read the notes before the lecture, we can actually make the lecture shorter, because we'll know you've read the notes and we can concentrate on the fun stuff rather than dragging you all feet first through the notes.
Or if people have questions from those notes, they can field them during. We can field those questions during the lecture. Okay, so I'll just ask a couple of general questions here, like what do you need to check before upgrading your operating system?
Definitely your backups.
Yeah, I agree, so I was just going to say that. Make sure everything's backed up.
Yep. How about if you've got any interesting hardware, checking the HCL?
Yeah, of course.
Minimum system requirements, you want to check those as well.
Yep.
Make sure all your software is compatible, or at least any you want to run.
Yeah, absolutely. Before installing an operating system, what do you have to do to make sure that your hard disk is ready for the operating system?
Absolutely.
Petition and inform it, that's right.
www.fdisk.com still exists. That used to actually be quite a nifty petition site.
And I can't quite remember what this one is, but Kerry will probably know. One of these questions here, I'm just randomly going through the questions before we go into the formal quiz. What's the command to convert FAT32 to NTFS?
I do know.
Upgrade, isn't it? Oh, that's it.
Yep, that's correct. Convert space drive colon space slash FS colon NTFS. And I think that was actually a question in one of the labs, and I don't actually ever remember... it wasn't in the notes, or was it in the notes? Because I remember one of our students...
I think it is in the notes. Let me just quickly...
I think it is, or you can just easily Google it. Actually, I think I did have to Google it.
Maybe you're right. Anyway, I have a feeling it's certainly... Well, there is a lab on it anyway, so certainly read it. And I have a feeling it's in the test.
I don't think it is. Or maybe it is. I don't know. But I remember having to Google it.
I actually went searching through the chapter notes, and it wasn't there. He said it wasn't there, and I actually read back through the notes, and now it's not in the test, but it is in the actual quiz. In one of the labs, and he actually said it wasn't in the notes, and I went back through over the notes, and he was right, it wasn't there. So we had to Google it up. And yes, fdisk.com still exists, just out of morbid curiosity.
Well, we're actually a little bit ahead of time, so we can do one of a couple of things. Let's go with the quiz, eh? I was going to say, what do we want to do? More discussion, I go with the quiz. Okay, are we ready for the quiz, guys?
Yes.
All right.
It's rock and roll.
Question
Everybody
one.
In the chat windows, since we do have someone new here, and some new students that are going to be coming into our class who are probably listening to this lecture. The quiz is where everybody gets into their chat windows, and you can write the letter of the answer into your chat window, or if we're doing yes or no, Y and N is good.
And you should know that if you listen to lecture one, because she said exactly the same thing then. So now you should know it doubly good.
All right, let's go. Question one, which open source operating system is available on multiple hardware platforms? A, Linux. B, Mac OS. C, Windows 2000. Or D, Windows XP. Go now.
And the trick there is open source, because Mac OS X is available on multiple platforms, however it's not open source, and Windows is no longer available on multiple platforms unless you call 64-bit and 32-bit multiple platforms. Windows NT used to run on the DEC Alpha, and it also used to run on MIPS. Oh, and the AMD 64, yeah.
Question two. Which registry file contains information about the hardware and the software in the computer system? Now, this is a registry key. We didn't really go over it, but it is in the notes. And that is A, H key local classes root. H key classes root. B, H key current user. C, H key local machine. And D, HKey_user. For those who got C, you are correct. That's everybody. Okay, question three. How can the command line be accessed in Windows XP? A, start run prompt. B, start run CMD. C, start control panel prompt. D, start all programs accessories terminal. and E, start run terminal. Go now. Yep, for everybody who got B, you are correct.
One little tip, if we could wait until all answers are read to press enter on our answers, that would be good, because then everybody gets a chance to answer. No problem.
We all do get a little bit trigger happy on the enter key, and we do hit it early sometimes. Although what you can do if you're feeling really, really nasty is you can actually hit enter on the wrong answer and see how many students you can confuse.
Question four, which file system is recommended for Windows XP for large file support and enhanced security? A, DirectX. B, DOS. C, FAT32. D, HPFS, or E, NTFS. Go now. Question 5. What is the purpose of the Microsoft Hardware Compatibility List? A, it lists all the hardware that runs Microsoft Office software. B, it lists Microsoft software that runs on the listed hardware. C, it lists hardware that is supported by a Microsoft operating system. D, it lists hardware that works together. Go now.
That it is.
Chris said it's great to imagine paper airplanes. Yeah, let's see if you want to print it out. The correct answer is C, it lists hardware that is supported by a Microsoft operating system.
We did that one afternoon, actually. We were all sitting around doing a Cisco lecture, and I made a comment about paper airplanes, and Bianca and Gemma said, we've never made paper airplanes, and our fearless leader folded up and showed us how to make paper airplanes.
Fun.
Well, why not? Actually, we got that as a Toastmaster speech one night. Somebody did a speech on how to make paper airplanes, and we're all sitting around the room making paper airplanes. Jeez, it was fun.
That's always a fun little time waster.
Just a sad note that the Thursday chats are currently been retired because of this volunteer Thursday class. We've got to figure out a better time to run them and where they won't collide with the class, and then we might bring them back. But we've had overwhelming demand to bring the Thursday chats back. However, if you do miss the Thursday chats, keep in mind that we've got every Thursday chat we ever did from the beginning of 2007, whereupon they were called the Fireside Chats, all the way through to when we stopped them, and they're all up on the server if anybody wants to listen to Thursday chats on all different sorts of programs and things. We've even got... It doesn't have to be Ventrilo, but if the students are signed up with us, you are allowed to use our Ventrilo server 24 hours a day, and on request we can create more accounts if you need them. It's just we don't want people on during the lecture to exceed our 50-user license limit, but we're paying for the 50-user license regardless.
Yeah, so if anyone can come up with a good time to have a Thursday chat and wants to run one, go for it.
So think about that, and if it was run somewhere else, we could certainly run it somewhere else, although I assume you can record TeamSpeak. We do try to record the Thursday chats, and we get some quite interesting topics.
Well, no, the...
This isn't an open Ventrilo server, so only people who are involved in the course can actually come onto the Ventrilo server, but anyone can download the Thursday chats off our website.
I'm going to have to bow out, folks.
Cheerio, Leon.
See you.
Okay, Leon. See you later on. Thanks for attending. Question 6. What should...
Yeah, okay. We'll let you know. Yep, we'll let you know. If we move the Thursday chats, you will all be informed, we promise. Because we know everybody's hanging out.
It's a case of time, isn't it? Because, yeah, we've got lectures on all 3 days now.
We were just saying that it could also be a good publicity thing to get people interested in the program if they listen to some of the Thursday chats and stuff. So we'll have to talk about that off lecture.
Well, can I make a little announcement here?
You may.
Yeah, or a request, actually. Sue is trying to, that's Sue Murray for anyone who doesn't know, is trying to get together a list of bouquets, actually, letters. If you could all please send a letter saying how much this course has meant to you, or lie a bit if it didn't. It's for our sponsors. We need to get money. And we put out a request a while back and got 2 letters. So I would sort of encourage you, please, just to write a note and send it to Ian Murray, i.murray@curtin.edu.au for Sue, or to Cavi Instructors. Probably that's the better spot to send it, actually, and we will forward them on to Sue. We need this for ongoing funding. Got to keep our sponsors happy.
It really doesn't take long to do. I did one a few months ago, 10 minutes, and it's really good for them to hear from blind people who have taken the course.
Yeah, no, thanks, guys. Yeah. And what we found was that people don't want to fund a course that isn't making changes in people's lives and stuff. So we need some evidence that it is actually making your guys' Wednesday nights or Thursday mornings or whatever a happier place, and that you're learning stuff out of it, or at least having fun, because that's important too. And yeah, if you could just put a couple of paragraphs down on how you're enjoying the course and whether or not you think they should continue. Because if nobody thinks this should continue, there won't be any more. So, yeah, just a little letter and send those through to Cavi instructors. You can certainly do that. And, in fact, we're infinitely bribable. No, we're not. But it does make us feel warm and fuzzy, and that will give you a better experience for you guys.
But in all sincerity, you know, if we don't have continuing funding for next year, we won't be on the airwaves. So, yeah, it's quite vital that we keep those that have been able to help us up to this point happy, and hopefully they might be able to continue to help us.
Sue's doing a lot of valuable work in that field, I know. All right, question six.
Weren't we up to five?
Did we do it? Hang on.
No, we did five. We're on to six.
What is the purpose of the HCL? Yeah, no, we did five. What should be done? Question six. What should be done before upgrading from Windows 2000 to Windows XP? Option A: backup all the data files. Option B: update all the device drivers. C: detach all the peripheral devices. D: download a legitimate XP authentication key. Go now. Gee, they're good. Okay, which key sequence, question 7, which key sequence will enable a user to start up Windows XP in safe mode? Option A, Alt plus B. Option B, Alt plus X. Option C, Alt plus Z. Option D, F1. Option E, F8. Option F, the Windows keys. And yes, go now.
Option G, a hammer.
Yes, option G, hammer.
Absolutely.
Rum and a hammer fixes all computer problems, isn't that right?
The American screwdriver, yep.
If I had a hammer.
Here we go with the songs. We haven't had one for a while.
No, I've been very quiet.
Yeah.
This is not a bad thing.
I was waiting for that.
Well, Sue's not here to stir up either.
That's all right.
Listen. I direct students to last year's lecture where there's a lot of Geraldine singing and a lot of Sue saying, "Please don't do it."
I sang too last year.
Yeah, and a little bit of help from Kerry too. Yeah.
We both sang with a bit of help from my co-lecturer.
Okay. I'd sing the songs you know, but I don't know them because I guess I'm too underdated.
What would you do if I sang out of tune?
Would you stand up and walk out on her? Yes. Are there any more quiz questions?
There are. There's two more questions.
Party people.
Let's rock and roll.
And we're going to get by with a little help from this quiz. What is the
great singing voice there, Christopher?
Question 8. What is an example of an open-ended question that a technician can ask a user about conditions before a failure? Option A. What software has been installed recently on the computer? B. Does the computer actually boot into the operating system? C. Are there any beeps when you turn on the computer? D. Has anyone else used the computer recently? Or E. How many users were logged onto the network when the failure occurred? Go now.
Or F. What the heck did you do to...
No, you can't ask that. That fails troubleshooting, remember?
Yes,
you
have it fails
to be I know, that was the point.
It's very accusative.
It's like the hammer.
Yes, those who got A, which I think was everybody who answered, are correct. Last question, which is question 9. Okay, question 9. What is the common cause of the error message, invalid system disk, quote unquote? Option A. The Del key was pressed during the system boot. B, there is a non-dash bootable floppy disk in the drive. C, there is no floppy disk or CD in the drive. D, the BIOS has been changed to boot from the hard drive first. Go now. Geez,
and in
good.
Fact, they've changed that message now.
B is the right answer.
If you format them under XP, I think it comes up with NTLDR missing or something. It's not non-system disk or disk error replace and strike any key. I must also point out that there is a kind of a feeling of terror when that message comes up when you're actually booting from a hard disk.
Yeah.
Yeah, what non-system disk? Oh my gosh, it's gone!
Oh, seriously, I've seen it happen. Yeah, no, missing operating system, that's my other favourite one.
Yeah, it's the other one, yep. Or in the DOS days, general failure reading drive C. Who is general failure and why is he reading my drive?
I just love the fatal errors.
Oh, the blue screen of death. By the way, everybody, here ended the lecture, so I hope you enjoyed it. And now it's time to have some fun.